the input were random variables, A, L, So we wanted to describe correlations. Between X and Y in each run N. Averaged over many runs. Okay, so we decided to consider a particular quantity, S, which was equal to expectation of A0, B0, plus A1, B1. A0, B1 plus A1, B0 minus A1, B1, where the expectation of AL, BK, what this quantity means is limit as n goes to infinity, 1 over n. Sum over n equals 1 to n x al times y bk. Okay, so we're averaging over runs with a fixed choice of l and k, a fixed choice of input to the measurement device, and then we look at the product of the values x and y, and then we take the average of the products. Okay, and then we went through a quick derivation. We derived the fact that S was bound between 2 and minus 2. This is called the CHSH inequality. And what we had to derive this, we had to make two assumptions. We made assumption one. We allowed for X and Y to depend on any common cause factors. We placed no restriction on the common cause factors. We just said, let's assume that there exist common cause factors. So here we have a backward light cone for detector B, and we have a backward light cone for detector A. And then this entire region here is the shared backward light cone of both events, which includes the source. So lambda characterizes the source, but it also characterizes anything you want in the past history, their shared past history. So this is the assumption of realism. We made no assumption about what lambda corresponded to. It could be the wave function. It could be the color of the paint on the source. It could be the name of the person that built the source. It could be hidden variables. It could be anything. It could be definite properties of the systems. We made no assumptions about it, except that it could possibly affect the outcomes. And we're not forcing it to affect the, I don't think we're actually forcing it to affect the outcomes. We're just allowing it to affect, we are allowing it to affect the outcomes. So this is not an assumption, but note that we allowed for a probabilistic dependence. Probabilistic dependence of x and y on lambda. So that was encoded in the fact that we wrote that so note we allowed, okay, note this is point A, and then let's note B is that we allowed for the possibility that lambda varied randomly from run to run. Okay, so the way we did that is we said, look, we're going to cash out this expression ALBK as being some integral over the different possible values that these causal factors might have. And we're going to allow for the product of XY. This, so XY is an event. And we allow for the event XY to depend on the input parameters to the detectors and any causal factors in the common cause past of the events XY. Okay, so here, so the point is that note is that fact. This refers to this fact, and star here refers to this fact that it's a probabilistic dependence. Okay, so in Bell's original theorem, he assumed that X and Y were determined by these factors, but CHSH, their innovation was to allow this dependence to be only probabilistic. Okay, then the second assumption, assumption two, was the assumption of locality. And there we assume that this probabilistic dependence was such that X could only depend on A and lambda and Y could only depend on B and lambda. So we assume that the probability of XY given A, B, lambda was equal to the probability of X given A and lambda times the probability of Y given B and lambda. And that allowed us to deduce this. And then now we'll see that quantum mechanics violates this assumption. Any questions about the setup? Yes.
X and Y, but it may contribute to the probability of measuring.
Yes. So it can act through a conditional probability, which is a very weak assumption. I don't know that it actually has to. I mean, I haven't thought about this carefully, but I assume the theorem goes through even if we drop lambda altogether from because then you can have, I mean, a lambda allows them to show some correlation. Remember, we thought about the CHSH game. The maximum correlation they're going to get if they have no common cause factors is a half, but they can get 75%. So I assume if you don't, if you drop lambda altogether, then you get a bound of the correlation is weaker. So S will be smaller. That'd be an interesting exercise, actually. Okay, good. So now the quantum mechanical prediction. We have a Hilbert space that's C2 tensor C2. And as I mentioned last class, ALBK is represented as the expectation of sigma dot AL hat. Okay, so these are directions of measurement of the spin operator. We take the input state rho to be a Bell singlet. So the Bell singlet is spin up, spin down, minus spin up, spin down, over square root of 2, which we can also write as, you know, minus 1 plus 1 minus plus 1 minus 1 over square root of 2. Now we can just define sigma dot, this unit vector is just sigma sub AL, right? It's just sigma along that direction. So it's a component. And similarly for B, and then it's a simple exercise to show that psi minus of sigma AL times sigma BK, here the hat refers to the fact that they're operators, in the state psi minus is just equal to minus AL dot BK. So the correlation is exactly the inner product between the directions. So notice if these are in the same direction in R3, then we get minus 1, which means they're perfectly anti-correlated, right? So if you have two spin half particles, they start out in zero angular momentum. This state has zero total angular momentum. So that means our spins are back to back. So if I choose two directions of measurement that are parallel, then for one of them I'll get plus 1 and the other one I'll get minus 1 because the spins are back to back by conservation of angular momentum. So it turns out that's not interesting to look at. You don't get a violation of the classical bound if you do that. To get a violation of the classical bound, you have to choose these angles to be non-trivial. So the choice of angle which gives the maximum violation, I'll draw for you. So we choose A1 to be 45 degrees from the z-axis, and we choose A0 to be 45 degrees in the opposite direction. And then we can just take B0 to be along z, and we can take B1 to be along x. So if we do that, we get S equals 2 root 2, which is the maximum violation. So this means that one of these assumptions, one of these two assumptions must be false, either locality or realism. And as I discussed, if you drop realism, it's not entirely clear what locality means. So one could probably argue that one either drops both or one just drops the locality assumption. Okay, so now there's some important things to remember. Okay, so a very simple fact is no signaling. No signaling is possible through this violation. Okay, so Alice and Bob can't send each other messages via their outcomes because their outcomes are random. They can't control the outcomes. Another issue is that this is a generalization of EPR. So Einstein, this generalizes EPR. EPR argument. So basically, you can think about this. You can think of two possibilities. So we think about the wave function. We can think about it as a physical object, or we can think about it as information about physical objects. I should call it properties. So in 1935, EPR said, hey, if you think about the wave function as a physical property, this means leads to a contradiction with locality. This implies non-locality. This was in 1935. And then what Bell showed is that the conflict with non-locality arises even if you don't assume the wave function is physical. Okay, this also leads to non-locality. This is Bell, 1965 or 66, whenever it was. Now Bell's theorem also implies that this case, also this implies non-locality via Bell's argument. So many times you'll hear people say, oh, we shouldn't think about hidden variables because we know from Bell's theorem you have to have non-locality, and non-locality is unpalatable. So we should just assume the wave function is physical, which is how you're often taught quantum mechanics. But we already knew 80 years ago that assuming the wave function is physical implies non-locality. So people just don't appreciate the fact that this was an extension of that result, not a separate result, really. Okay, so we have people want to cling to the idea of locality, so they look for loopholes in the experimental confirmation. Notice that if you go down this road, you're basically assuming quantum mechanics is wrong, because quantum mechanics predicts the violation. So it's a really funny position to be in, but nonetheless, people need something to do experiments about. So they do these experiments. So one is the detector efficiency loophole. So there the idea is, this is called the fair sampling loophole. So the idea is that because typically these experiments are done with photons, and photo detectors, the efficiency tends to be around, 80%, 70%, meaning that some significant fraction of the photons entering the photo detector don't trigger the light to go off. They don't trigger a detection event. So that means you're repeating this experiment, you're repeating these runs. Remember, we do, you know, big N number of runs. If a quarter of those runs you don't see the events, they just disappear, then you can actually construct a local loophole which says that, look, the detector just chooses not to answer, not to show the output when under a particular setting condition. So remember, the problematic case was that they're both asked question one. That led to a problem in the CHSH game. So if you could just choose not to answer when you're asked the question one some fraction of the time, then you can get away with, then you can show that you can argue that the experimental result doesn't violate Bell's inequality. So I wouldn't spend too much time worrying about it, but this is something people worry about. And the other thing is called the locality loophole. And that's just the simple fact that that you want to make sure that the random selection of the detector settings is done in a space-like separated way. So you're absolutely certain that there could have been no causal influence via, you know, signaling. And so you can overcome this by having the random detection events be selected, having the detection events be selected randomly at some very late stage in the game, so that you're not in the backwards light cone of the other detector. But this is problematic because, you know, what is independent? How is something really independent anyways? I mean, if everything goes back to the Big Bang, then everything's in its own backwards light cone. And so this kind of leads to the, as I mentioned last class, the superdeterminism argument. You have to assume that, the initial conditions at the Big Bang were contrived just so that we have the appearance of independent and random events in our lives, but exactly when you do a Bell test, then, you know, we stop pretending like things are independent and we don't have to believe the results of Bell experiments by assuming that the detector settings were predetermined 13 billion years ago. Which is, I think, you know, more outrageous than the idea of non-locality. So as you can imagine, this was, exciting stuff. People still kind of ponder it and try to understand it. As I mentioned last class, one of the big breakthroughs was to realize that this kind of philosophical issue actually is a resource that can be leveraged for quantum information. So the modern view is that non-locality is a resource. That can be leveraged for secure communication. Okay, so it brings a possibility of a form of privacy in communication that isn't possible classically. Yes.
In the CHSH game, does that mean that all vanellas both have a large number of entangled qubits?
To violate, yeah. So if they have 1,000 runs, they need 1,000 distinct entangled pairs.
I mean, for a single run.
For a single run, they need one Bell pair. Yeah, so basically the rule is this. So the way that Alice and Bob win at the CHSH game is that they have, you know, a smartphone from 2025. That actually has entangled pairs built into it. You know, you can, with your favorite friend, you can match the phones up, get entangled pairs, and then later on, if you're put in these contraptions, what you do is you measure your spin half particle along an axis determined by the question the referee asks you. So if the question asks you zero and you're Alice, you measure your Bell pair along this direction, your half of the Bell pair. And if you're asked question one, you measure this way. And then the answer you give is the outcome of that measurement, plus one or minus one. And Bob does likewise, but his axis system is different. So there's some kind of, you can refer to the stars, for example. There's some absolute reference frame. You have a gyroscope in your phone, so you know your exact orientation. Because these have to be done in the same reference frame, obviously. So your phone would have to have a gyroscope and bell pairs. And it's a resource that gets consumed. That's the neat part. And then the whole point is to create that. Like when we studied what does it mean to have separable states and so on, the point is a separable state is one that can be created by classical communication. But an entangled state is one you have to be together to create it. So you have to be together to create the resource, and then when you're separated, you can achieve things that you couldn't achieve otherwise. We don't know. I mean, it's just pure speculation. We don't know how it works. I mean, there are interpretations that give stories, but it's just guesswork. It's speculation.
But you say if there's no limitation, the Bell's theorem has to be true. So if Bell's inequality does not hold for the quantum system, isn't that it implied that
I don't know the best way to answer that question. I think the point is that what you can do is you can look to a story like Bohmian mechanics, which gives a story for how this happens. And there the story is that that any change you make over here instantaneously changes the quantum potential through all of space. So that's problematic because there's a preferred reference frame which violates the principles of GR. So there's a conflict there and things like that. But yeah, really it's just speculation. All we know is the assumptions fail. We don't know how they fail or why they fail. Okay? Good. Anyways, you can think about this some more. It's neat stuff. Let me talk about a few things about entanglement versus non-locality. Okay, so we have entanglement is necessary for violation of a Bell type inequality. But not sufficient.
Sorry.
Okay, so there are entangled states which cannot violate a Bell inequality. So that puts us in a little bit of an awkward situation trying to understand the difference between these two things. And it turns out what you have to realize is that a Bell experiment, what do we mean by Bell type inequality? What we mean is that there's two parties and they have two possible measurements and those measurements have two possible outcomes. So that's an unnecessary constraint. We can consider generalized scenarios even with two parties. We can give them more than one measurement setting to choose from. We can use higher dimensional systems which have more than one outcome. They can do POVM measurements, which have more than one outcome on a two-level system. So there's lots of different types of scenarios you can explore to see in this scenario what is a classical bound on the correlations and can quantum mechanics violate that bound. And then when you do that, you can ask, for that new type of inequality, is entanglement sufficient to get a non-locality violation? So when I say that entanglement is not sufficient to violate a Bell-type inequality, it's because we're only looking at a very restricted scenario. And there's a much more general scenario we can explore. So it's unclear if in traditional traditional measurements with so many settings and so many outcomes, it could be that entanglement, there's always some situation where some entangled state is useful and leads to a violation of locality. And very recently, there's been some work by Buscemi in 2012 and Massans, Liang, and Doherty, which was in 2008. And what they showed is that any, what's the right statement here? Any entangled state is useful for some violation of locality. Okay, so that's a really nice result because it gives us a pretty clean story that somehow non-locality and entanglement are very, very similar concepts in the quantum setting. So it's possible to construct classical models that have entanglement, but they can't be non-local. So entanglement in the quantum formalism always leads to non-locality, but entanglement in other toy theories and formalisms doesn't necessarily imply non-locality. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, so in the Schrodinger's cat argument where you're saying, look, quantum mechanics predicts a coherent superposition of these two states, but we assume, kind of based on our experience, that the cat is either alive or dead and not in some kind of simultaneous state of both. Yeah, I think that's a stronger notion of realism. That's kind of the full classical realism that all macro objects have definite properties. And we don't need anything that strong for Bell's inequality. Okay. I guess I'll give you guys a choice here, maybe. I'd be interested to tell you a little bit about contextuality, which is a generalization of non-locality. I could also tell you a bit about the Poisson bracket formulation of dynamical theories, which gives classical mechanics and quantum mechanics as special cases, or I could do both. How much interest is there in about a 10-15 minute discussion of contextuality? All right, good, so let's do that. So so the idea is the following. Can we assume that measurement outcomes always reveal pre-existing properties of the system being measured? Okay, we're, you know, Bohr insisted that we don't believe that. You know, Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum theory, said, hey, you can't assume that systems have physical properties until they're measured. Now, Bohr insisted that because that was his belief and his understanding of quantum mechanics. There's actually a funny comment that Heisenberg made. Remember, when Heisenberg described his uncertainty principle, he said, look, you know, the particle has a position and a momentum, and I send in a photon, and it has some frequency, and because the frequency and the energy are inversely proportional by the speed of light, when I try to measure the position of the photon to some precision delta x, I increase the energy of the photon, so I get a smaller wavelength. And the smaller the wavelength of the photon, the higher resolution I have in measuring its position. And then that photon will bounce off the electron, it'll be scattered, then get scattered into a lens, and we collect the event, and we isolate the position of the electron to some precision delta x, which is proportional to the wavelength of the incident light. And then he's like, but notice that if we want to talk about the momentum of the electron after the detection event, then the higher the energy of the photon, the bigger the momentum kick I'm going to give to that electron. So as I try to increase my resolution in spatial resolution of delta x, I'm increasing my uncertainty delta p in the kick that the electron is going to get from the impact of that detection event. So that's a well-known fact, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, great. Now notice that Bohr gave Heisenberg a hard time and said, hey, Heisenberg was like junior to Bohr. And so Bohr said, hey, Heisenberg, that's, you know, don't publish that because it's wrong. You can't talk about particles having positions, and your whole analysis assumes that microscopic objects have well-defined positions and momenta. And, you know, I'm telling you that's wrong. You're not allowed to talk that way. And so Heisenberg was kind of aggravated by this. And then, so at some point, like much later, like in the 30s or something, when Bohr was having these debates with Einstein about how to interpret quantum mechanics, Heisenberg is out sailing with Bohr and a bunch of Bohr's high school friends. And they're out sailing, and Bohr is all excited to tell his high school friends about quantum mechanics and what it tells us about reality and what it, you know, there is no reality, and we, the only things that exist are things that we observe, and yada, 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 and this is all a consequence of quantum mechanics. And one of his high school friends, so Bohr was a big fan of turn-of-the-century German philosophy, and one of his high school friends turned back to him and said, wait, that's exactly what you thought in high school. So what you see is that Bohr kind of imposed his philosophical prejudices onto the interpretation. And because he was this huge figure in the field who determined everybody's careers, you know, people were like, okay, we have to listen to this guy, we have to do what he says. And he opposed that view, and that's been received as the interpretation of quantum mechanics. So Bohr tells us we can't make this assumption. But you know, then the question is, well, okay, let's not just trust Bohr's opinion, let's evaluate, can we believe this or can't we? Can we prove that this is untenable? And so contextuality proves that this is untenable. Now, before you say, hey, that's inconsistent with the way you've been talking about quantum mechanics all month, if we show that this is false, which is what we're going to show, it doesn't imply that the properties don't pre-exist. It just implies we're breaking the connection between the outcome we get and the pre-existing property. So we're a demonstration of contextuality, a negative answer to this question can be interpreted in two ways. One, properties don't pre-exist. Or two, they do pre-exist, but the outcome you get isn't just a function of that property. It depends on other things. It depends on other contextual factors. So I'll tell you what contextuality is, and then I'll tell you how non-locality is an instance of contextuality, a special case. So we're just going to consider two spin-half particles. And we're going to consider a collection of 9 different observables. Can never memorize this. Sigma x A, sigma x B. I've got this backwards. Here it's B, here it's A. Sigma x A times sigma x B sigma YA, sigma YB, sigma YA, sigma YB, sigma XB, sigma YA, sigma XA, sigma YB, and sigma ZA, sigma ZB. So these are our 9 observables. And then what we're going to want to do is we're going to talk about, we want to assign, our goal is to assign pre-existing values to each observable. Okay, so we're going to take some observable sigma, and we're going to assign some value to it. Okay, let me call it sigma I. Yes. Here? Here? Oh, this is an X. This is the X component of, sorry, I'm having a sloppy writing day for some reason. So this is the poly operator sigma, the X component of it for system B. And then we're just looking at different combinations of these poly components. So you can put the tensor's product symbol in here if it makes you happy, but you don't have to. So the point is we're taking, look, I'm measuring spin Z. I'm checking, is the spin up or down along the Z axis? I get outcome either +1 or -1. So let's assume that whether I got +1 or -1, which is this outcome V, let's assume that that was the property that the spin had. It had +1 or -1 along that axis prior to me measuring it. Let's assume that's true for any of these potential observables. So I'm going to talk about the value assigned to each of these observables. And now, what are the possible values? Well, you expect that the value assigned to any observable A is an element of the eigenspectrum of A. Okay, the eigenvalues of A. So because these are spin operators, here we've taken away the h-bar over 2, so these eigenvalues are +1 and -1. So that means our values have to be +1 and -1. So for any poly operator, either, you know, sigma I or sigma IA tensor sigma JB, the value is always either -1 or +1. Yes?
The operators that are multiplied together, is that the same as the tensor product?
So these are all tensor products. Because it's redundant here because this means it's on system A, which is Hilbert space A. And this is on system B, which means it's Hilbert space B. So, I mean, just I want to make sure you guys don't miss something. When you did wave mechanics, when you guys in undergrad, you did a particle in a two-dimensional box, you would talk about the wave function in the xy plane. If it was a product state, you said, okay, well, I have my eigenstates of sigma x, and then I have my eigenstates along the x-axis and my eigenstates along the y-axis. And I can write any state as a linear combination of these eigenstates, right? And you wrote it this way. So you weren't using a tensor product then either, but that's what that was, right? This is a tensor product. But it's just regular multiplication. Just like for joint, like you would do for probability vectors. If I have probability vectors describing joint events, you just multiply them together. And you're implicitly using a tensor product, but no one actually makes that explicit. Okay, so yes, this is all tensor producted. We have 2 systems, and so the tensor product structure divides up. We have the spin half we're calling A and the spin half we're calling B. Now, the other thing is to remark that for commuting operators, because we're assuming, the question we're assuming is that we have pre-existing values, and because commuting operators can be measured in any sequence and repeatedly, if we have operators A, B, and C that all commute, we can measure A, then C, then B, then A again, then C, then B, we can do whatever we want. So we assume that for commuting operators A, B, and C, we would want the value assigned to the product of those operators. This is regular multiplication now, because these are all in the same system. These are all in the same Hilbert space. We would want that to be equal to a product of the values. Okay, so the measurement outcomes are revealed values, so we expect these revealed values to multiply the way standard numbers do. So given these assumptions, we can now derive a contradiction. Okay, we can now derive a contradiction. I should say that this is called the Perez-Mermin square. So here's the trick. Recognize that the Pauli operators in any row commute, and the Pauli operators in any column commute. So that's the first point. The second point is that if I multiply the operators together in any row like this, I get the identity operator. All right, so for any row, we have ABC is equal to identity. For the first two columns, I have ABC multiplied to identity. And for the third column, I have ABC multiplied to minus identity. Okay, so what that means is that if you take these three operators and multiply them together, you get minus identity. Let's just look at that. So we'll take sigma x A tensor sigma x B times sigma y A tensor sigma y B times sigma z A tensor sigma z B. So now everything on the left of the tensor symbol multiplies with itself. All the A's go together. So we get sigma x times sigma y, which is, you guys can correct me when I make a mistake, is minus I sigma z, I think, times sigma z. And we tensor that with, again, sigma x sigma y is, minus I sigma z tensor sigma z. So the minus signs cancel. The i's give us minus 1. This is a mistake. We have the fact that sigma zb squared is equal to identity, similarly for a. So we get I squared times the identity operator on a, tensored with the identity operator on b, which is just minus the identity operator on AB. And now if you do that for the first two columns or any of the rows, you get plus identity AB. All right, but what value can I assign? The value assigned to identity AB has to be an eigenvalue. The only eigenvalue of the identity operator is 1. But the value assigned to minus identity operator must be minus 1, because all its diagonal elements are minus 1. So now let's think about what that means. If I multiply all 9 elements together, so I multiply these 3 together, I'm going to get plus 1. These 3 give plus 1. These 3 give plus 1, which means the product, the row-wise product of all these values is plus 1. The column-wise product, if I just now proceed in a different direction, this is plus 1, this is plus 1, this is minus 1. So the column-wise product of all the values is minus 1. So this means that the the product of all the values of all value assignments must be plus 1, and it must be minus 1, which is a contradiction. Okay, so that means we can't think about the measurement outcomes as being pre-existing values, as being associated with pre-existing values. That doesn't mean the pre-existing values didn't exist, but rather the outcome we get wasn't necessarily the property the system had. So an analogy for this, which Lucien Hardy first told me some 10 years ago, is to think about if you're baking a souffle in the oven. So a souffle is this special cake you make where you do something so that it gets all puffy. And it's very sensitive to vibrations, all right? So if you jump around in the kitchen, or if you open the oven door to check it, the vibrations of opening the door cause the souffle to collapse, or can cause the collapse. So we classically, it's entirely possible to have a mechanical explanation of a situation where the measurement process means the outcome you observe is different than the property that the system had prior to measurement. That just happens in baking. So all this is telling us that also happens in quantum mechanics. Yes?
In this derivation of the Cauchy-Specker theorem, I think, right?
Yes, this is a simplified version of the Cauchy-Specker theorem.
Yeah. We've assumed that the measurement is correctly and completely described by the Hilbert space formalism, right?
Sure.
Yeah, so what we've proven is that if the Hilbert space formalism is correct and complete, then measurement does.
I think I can accept that.
Okay. So it's somewhat weaker than the statement that's there.
If the measure, what do you mean by complete? The measurement formalism is complete. What does that mean? Like complete in its ability to predict the statistics of what we observe? That I would agree with that.
Well, that there's nothing else going into the values that we measure. Nothing outside.
Okay. I think I know what you're getting at. So remember that quantum mechanics doesn't predict outcomes of single events, single measurements. It predicts the probability of that outcome. So you seem to be playing off this idea that does complete mean something that predicts the exact outcome I will get in this run, or does complete mean something that will predict the probability over long runs? Okay, so I mean, yeah, so sure, there are subtleties there, absolutely. Those are all interesting questions, but I mean, that's something that requires a lot of thinking, I think, to sort through. But yeah, I think you're on the right track. These are the kinds of distinctions you have to make to kind of get a full understanding of what's going on here. Any other questions about this? Yes?
When you take the value, how do you know which eigenvalue?
That's a good question. So it doesn't matter. Like, when we derive that the product of all these has to be plus one row-wise, it could be that we have an even number of minuses distributed anywhere, but it has to be an even number of minuses. And we do the column-wise multiplication, we get minus 1, which means there has to be an odd number of minuses. So you can assign plus 1s and minus 1s as you wish, but the assumptions we made implied that there's a constraint on how many plus 1s and minus 1s can be assigned, whether it's even or odd, and we get inconsistent constraints there. Did that help? I don't know if that helped. Did that clarify? Yeah, so you're free. The point is we're not specifying that it has to be a particular outcome, just that it's one of these. Now, there's subtleties here. So talking about two different rows, we're talking about different experimental arrangements. So Bohr would be very unhappy about this. I mean, of course, Ibai Fiat said we shouldn't even ask this question. So of course he's unhappy. But these are incompatible experimental arrangements. So, you know, this operator doesn't commute with this operator. So when it comes to actually talking about an experimental test, things get a little bit murky because we can only really measure one row or one column on any given system. And if we want to measure a different row or a different column, we have to press the go button again, change our knob on our measurement apparatus, and then we're measuring a different collection of observables. So we can't kind of directly test this, which is why otherwise we'd run into a contradiction. So there's something called a counterfactual assumption, we're assuming, we're assigning values to measurements that we haven't actually performed and can't actually perform. If we're measuring this row, then we can't measure this row. So that's one subtlety. The other thing I wanted to tell you is how this is how Bell's theorem is a special case. So one way you can kind of, you know, sleep at night after this result is to take the view that I took. This is how I sleep at night, is to think, okay, so this is just telling us that the outcome I'm going to get isn't just a function of the property of the system, but some internal degrees of freedom of the apparatus or some other features of nature are coming into play to co-determine this outcome. And it's not such a big deal. You know, I told you about the souffle example, right? This isn't such a scary thing. So, but here's the rub. So the reason why it's called contextuality is because we say that the outcome you get depends on the context. So think about measuring this guy. The point is, the value I'm going to get if I measure XX depends on the context of whether I measure XX via this measurement, which is an entangling measurement of both systems, or if I measure XX via this measurement, which involves doing independent measurements on each system and computing the answer. So there's two ways to measure XX. One involves bringing the systems together and doing a joint measurement on them, and the other involves, that's this column, and the other involves just actually keeping the systems apart and just measuring them and then calculating what this is, right? Because this should be equal to V times V. So I can just, I don't have to, Alice and Bob don't have to be together to do this, but they have to be together to do this. So the way we interpret this is that the value you're going to get depends on the context of how you do the measurement, which is, again, not such a big deal. But here's where it gets interesting. Think about Bell's theorem. What we said is Alice is over here, and she's choosing some measurement setting. And Bob is over here, and he's choosing some measurement setting. And what Bell's theorem is telling us is that the outcome that Bob gets seems to depend on the choice of measurement. Remember, what do we violate with Bell's inequality? We violated the assumption of independence, that the outcome I got here was independent of whatever happened over here, whether it's the choice of the measurement setting or whether it's the outcome I get. So this is exactly an instance of contextuality. We're saying that the outcome Bob gets, if we assume that it can't depend on Alice's setting, then we get S must be less than or equal to 2. But S is greater than 2 experimentally, which means that Bob's outcome depends on the context of what Alice chose to do over here in a space-like separated manner. So Bell's non-locality is an instance of contextuality, but it's the most interesting instance because we have special relativity telling us that should be impossible. So that's how this all fits together. So I'll let that simmer with you. And then just to make a plug, I mentioned last class, but I just want to plug my own work. So last year, my postdocs and I and a student published a paper in Nature where we showed that contextuality is necessary for quantum mechanical speedup, for quantum computational speedup. That's a question we haven't been able to answer. So what we show is that if you have a set of operations in your quantum computer and those operations admit a description, a non-contextual description, so there's no contradiction of this form that's possible with the states you're using and the measurements you're using, then we can classically simulate with no overhead. Basically, there's no speed up possible. You have nothing better than a classical computer. And so, in other words, in order to get a quantum computer to outperform a classical computer, you have to have a set of operations available to you that lead to a violation of non-contextuality. So this is part of kind of the way I'm teaching this course is in part to kind of inspire you to think about how, you know, this the weirdness of quantum mechanics and these kind of foundational questions can actually be enlightening in answering kind of very important open problems that confront the field in terms of understanding the capabilities of quantum mechanics for information theory and condensed matter theory and possibly also for unification of quantum mechanics and gravity. Of course, that's all speculative, but you know, you got to have some hope to move forward. So that's my hope. Okay. I'm sure that was a lot. So next class. How many of you would be interested in seeing this Poisson bracket formulation of quantum mechanics and classical mechanics? Okay, what's the alternative though? So the alternative is I could do a lot of different things. The other most compelling alternative, for me at least, would be to give you some introduction to quantum information. So talk about, you know, what is quantum information? What is quantum speed up? What is the circuit model? Maybe simple examples, what's quantum teleportation, things like that. How many of you would be interested in that? A smaller fraction. All right, so Poisson brackets it is. All right, great. Thanks for your questions today.